This is Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston, and you're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5 FM in McLean County and 92.5 FM in good old Bloomington Normal, 88.3 in Pontiac, 97.1 in Lincoln. That's a 110-mile strip up and down the good old double nickel, all the way from just south of Lincoln to north of Pontiac. So we've got a big broadcasting area. And if you would like to be a sponsor, contact us at 807-2427. That's area code 309, 807-2427. Or better yet, go to our website, and that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. Again, that's CatholicSpiritRadio.com. And you'll find out a lot of information about us on that site and some of the things that you can get or participate in, how to make a donation, and how to be a sponsor of Catholic Spirit Radio. Because you have to remember, we are brought to you by you. We're a listener-sponsored station, and we need your help to stay on the air and to keep all of our good work up. And you can find out a lot of it, again, right there on our website. We're going to have a great show for you today. I'm here with my wife, Lynn. We were off last week, of course, and you had to miss because of some conflicts that we had and John had. So we're back again today, and we're going to continue with Joseph Pierce's literature, Whatever Catholics Should Know, and we'll get into some of the metaphysical and romantic poets and talk a little bit about how that relates to our time and to Catholicism. I think my wife, Lynn, here with me, has something to say about the church. I think she wanted to make some comments on. So I'm going to turn it over to him and then to him.
Him.
Turn it over to her.
59 years later, he still can't.
Awesome.
Oh, my, we in trouble.
I'm always getting myself in trouble. Always putting my foot in the wrong place, I guess.
Good grief.
But at any rate, I'm going to turn it over to her. I don't know.
That's going to be a classic.
I guess I was trying to say Joseph Pierce, literature, whatever Catholics should know, and had that in mind, and I switched over to talking about Lynn and said him, and meant, I don't know what I meant. Anyhow, we'll get back on track. I'm going to turn it over to my wife.
To divulge into that one.
Let her put her foot in her mouth instead of me doing it all the time.
Okay, well, sit by and watch. Listen.
That'll be nice.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It caught my attention this week in the New Catholic Post. It's from published date of this Sunday, October 27th, 2019, is the status of two churches in Spring Valley. Now, we have some close ties there. I received all my sacraments in St. Peter and Paul. That was my home parish. In fact, that's where we were married. The other parish is the Immaculate Conception Church in Spring Valley. They have not been in use for several years now. They were closed and we're down to one parish in the community. This community used to be very, very ethnic community, and there were four Catholic churches. There was St. Anne's, which was Lithuanian people supported. St. Peter and Paul was Polish, and Immaculate Conception, we always called it the Irish Church. I think it was Irish-German people that founded that one. Let's see, there's one, two, three.
St. Anthony's.
Oh, St. Anthony's. I always have a block there. That's the Italian church. St. Anthony's was totally rebuilt about 20 years ago or whatever. And that's now the place of the original, the home of the Catholic parishes in Spring Valley. They've been all merged into the Nativity, the Church of the Nativity of Our Lord. But in reading this, it's kind of sad statement about our society that in a parish, in a community of 5,000 people, there hadn't been enough Catholics to support four Catholic churches. We're now down to one. What has happened? You know, that's one question. What has happened? The people are leaving the church. It's very disturbing. But I think in the same, there's a article in the same Catholic Post about the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. are now more than those that declare that are practicing Catholics. This is not a good thing for our society or our families, anything. It's almost kind of heartbreaking. But getting back to the statuses of the church, two churches, according to the Post, these two Catholic churches were built more than a century ago in Bureau County. And the new decrees issued this month by Daniel Jenke, our bishop, these two churches, which have been in limited use since 2012, when the merger of the three Spring Valley parishes into the new faith community of the Nativity of Our Lord, have been relegated to profane use, not sordid use. Now, these terms are, to me, are kind of confusing, but...
Well, profane just means secular, basically.
Right.
It doesn't really necessarily always mean bad.
And the designation allows for the possible eventual sale or demolition of the churches. Such future decisions are still being studied, according to Father Scott Puthoff, administrator of our Nativity of Our Lord Parish. The decrees issued after local consultation with written recommendations of the diocese council took effect on October 18th and are being published here. They state that if sold, the properties may not be used for a sordid purpose that would be offensive to the faith. Any sacred vessels, furnishings, or vestments must be dispersed according to the norms of the law in a manner consistent with their sacred character. I imagine a lot of these things will be dispersed throughout the diocese and further within other churches that are in need of things. St. Peter and Paul, located on Terry Street, Spring Valley, was built in 1909 and was formally consecrated by Bishop Edmund Dunn in 1920. It is widely considered to be the first Polish consecrated church in the United States. And a metal plaque with Polish inscription was placed in the vestibule to commemorate the historic event. The parish was formed in 1891 and was first served by a framed wooden church. The Immaculate Conception is on Greenwood Street in Spring Valley, was built in 1917 after the original church was destroyed by fire. Immaculate Conception Parish in Spring Valley was founded in 1884 and is considered the mother church for those Catholic faith communities that followed. In recent years, the churches have hosted three annual scheduled masses as well as a monthly rosary service. And I know at St. Peter and Paul, occasionally there would be some funerals held there. In fact, my sister-in-law was buried out of there, out of St. Peter and Paul, 2 years ago. Mold was found in the buildings, and since they're not been in much use, that's what has led to this decree. So I know they both have a big area of property there, both the parishes. So it's just sad to see this go, so many memories. And I know this is happening in many communities throughout the diocese in the United States, and I suppose elsewhere too. It just brought a veil of sadness to me to see this happening. Bob's home parish was St. Anne's in Spring Valley, and it closed probably 10 years ago.
Oh, longer ago than that, yeah.
So
I would say probably more like 20 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. The older you get, the closer it seems. It doesn't seem that long.
We're pretty close to it anyway.
But I think that it shows, you know, the decline in our communities, especially in our faith community. It is really sad. But, you know, if you want to relate this, we can go back with this all the way back to what Bob's going to be talking about in literature today. The the ebb and tide of things as life goes on.
And we'll
let you get to that.
Yeah, we'll get to the fact that one of the things that is really important, and you'll see why I think as we go along, is for the Catholic Church to remain the same, to remain Orthodox, and to be there when people return and need it again. Because this happens over and over, and it's happened before, and it will happen again. And it's more important to be faithful than it is to be successful. So that we'll see how some of the literature that we're going to talk about points that out. At any rate, we're going to talk again about some of the great literature. Last time we were here 2 weeks ago, we talked about Cervantes. And today we're going to talk about some of the metaphysical poets in this book by Joseph Pierce, what every Catholic should know. And again, Joseph Pierce is director of book publishing at the Augustine Institute. He's editor of the St. Austin Review and the author of books on Shakespeare, Tolkien, Chesterton, and other Christian literary figures. He's got an autobiography out also, A Race with the Devil, which is an extremely good book. So if you have a chance, I think you can get it, the book, over at the Dwelling Place in Normal, just west of the Kroger store area there on the north side of College Street and College Avenue. And you could get also Catholic Answers. You can go to everycatholic.organization and learn more there, or Google the Augustine Institute, Ignatius Press, and get the book. It's worth having.
Right, but we should be supporting our local Catholic bookstore.
That's right. At any rate, in the history of English literature, a place of honor is held by the metaphysical poets. And, of course, metaphysical means, you know, above the physical. Beyond physical, we're talking more about philosophy and theology when we get into what we call the metaphysical. And it says, even though there is much disagreement with regard to what exactly is meant by the label and with regard to which poets deserve to have the label appended to them, those poets usually labeled as metaphysical include John Donne, George Herbert, Robert Southwell, or Southwell, it's spelled Southwell, and we've talked about Southwell when we talked about Shakespeare, Andrew Marvel, Henry Vaughan, and Richard Crashaw. We will be looking at four of these: Donne, Herbert, Southwell, and Crashaw. Before we do, let us take a look at what is normally meant by what is called metaphysical poetry. Helen Gardner, one of the great scholars of the metaphysical poets, concentrates on the role of the conceit as the most immediately striking feature of metaphysical poetry. Her artfully succinct definition of the metaphysical conceit is worth quoting as a key that helps us understand the genre. A conceit is a comparison whose ingenuity is more striking than its justness, or at least is more immediately striking. All comparisons discover likenesses in things unlike. A comparison becomes a conceit when we are made to concede likeness while being strongly conscious of unlikeness. A brief comparison can be a conceit if two things patently unlike, or which we should never think of together, are shown to be alike in a single point, in a single way, or in such a context that we feel their incongruity. Here a conceit is like a spark made by striking two stones together. After the flash, the stones are just two stones. Metaphysical poetry abounds in such flashes. And so that's a pretty good definition. And if you would think, for example, in John Donne, John compares his love, the woman that he loves, to a compass. And when I say a compass, not a compass that tells the direction, of geographical direction, but a compass that you draw circles with on a paper. And so two very unlike things are the man and the woman are two points on the compass, and, they draw circles, and two very unlike things are compared to each other. Donne also writes a poem called The Flea, in which he compares his love to a flea. I mean, imagine that, and just think of that, and you think, how can that possibly be? But he pulls it off.
Yeah, he does. I kind of enjoyed reading that.
Right. And he compares a man to an island in one of his poems. You know, it's normally called, you know, no man is an island. It was, you know, for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. And Ernest Hemingway took his title on one of his books, For Whom the Bell Tolls, from John Donne's poem, you know, comparing man to an island. And I want to mention here also, these are all English and, you know, European poets that we're talking about here. And I want to mention that there was an American poet in the same era, in the 1600s, Edward Taylor. And he wrote metaphysical poetry, and no one knew about that metaphysical poetry until the 1930s. A manuscript of his poems was found behind a painting, and I think it was at Yale University. I think it was. I'm pretty sure it was Yale. And the reason that it was never brought to light sooner, because Edward Taylor, being a Puritan and living in Puritan New England, had to keep it hidden. I mean, that type of poetry did not go very, you know, wasn't really approved or
wasn't looked on favorably at all.
Yeah, with favor by the people in Puritan New England, although there were some people who called themselves Puritan in England that did engage in metaphysical poetry. But so there's a, and in Robert Taylor's poem, he compares one of his poems, he compares the universe being made, you know, our solar system, our planets and so forth, being bowled into existence in a bowling alley, you know, and people bowled back at that time. They had bowling greens. They didn't, the alley was out in, you know, the open. It wasn't inside of some building or something, but they bowled out on the green. And he compares this, God making man and the universe and so forth, to a bowling alley. And so these very unlike things, and he brings it off. In another one of his poems, he compares God to a farmer, and he doesn't bring it off. It fails. It becomes almost funny. And, but that can happen with metaphysical poetry. So I just wanted to bring that up, that, you know, there was something in our own country here back at that time. So we know that probably Edward Taylor had to be aware of what was going on back in England, and probably aware of the metaphysical poets there. For him to be able to write in that, you know, line of poetry. At any rate, Gardner's definition of conceit is remarkably similar to the Chestertonian understanding of paradox, which can be defined as an apparent contradiction pointing to a deeper truth. And, you know, Chesterton talks about paradox in the same way as a conceit. One of Chesterton's common sayings you might have heard of is when there was the huge argument during Chesterton's time over capitalism versus socialism. And some of the people that Chesterton hung around with were socialists, and Chesterton, of course, shied away from socialism, was in, you know, championed capitalism. But Chesterton said, the problem with capitalism is not too many capitalists, like people were saying, but not enough capitalists. And that's sort of a paradox, that something that people were disparaging, he said, was bad only because there weren't enough of them. And that seems like a paradox, but then when Chesterton brings that out, it's true. If more people own property, Chesterton in effect was saying, own their own homes and own some property and owned the means of production of some of the things in their life and so forth, everybody would be better off, and that would be a form of capitalism that Chesterton championed. And they called it, Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc called that distributism, meaning that the capitalism and the ownership of goods should be distributed among more people, and that the production should be distributed as well. Among more people, there should be a greater distribution of goods and services, even though there should be a retention of private ownership. So it was a paradox, and yet at the same time, it was sensible.
But well, that makes sense. Then the more people that have ownership and have a vested interest in something, the more diverse the control is.
That's true. But Chesterton was very noted for that. It makes you wonder, did Chesterton take some of those ideas, that paradoxical ideas, from the metaphysical poets? Because his, you know, his writings and so forth, and he wrote a lot of essays and so forth, and they are full of these paradoxes that seem paradoxical, and then as he explains them, they become very, very sensible. So Chesterton also said another example. Chester said, everyone, you know, he took that saying, everyone should keep an open mind. And he says, but an open mind is good only if it crunches down on the right thing from time to time. So at any rate, I guess I'm over my time here. We're going to have to stop and take a break. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
This weekend, we have a text fundraiser where your donations will be tripled thanks to the support of three matching donors. So for every dollar received, Catholic Spirit Radio will receive $4 thanks to our matching donors. Thank you in advance to Dave Stokes of Edward Jones, Dr. Sarah Round of Pediatric Smiles in Bloomington, and an anonymous donor. Simply text GIVE to 309-233-0086 anytime between now and Sunday night. That's GIVE to 309-233-0086.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. We're back from our break. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio, and we're talking about literature, What Every Catholic Should Know by Joseph Pierce again this week, and we're talking about the metaphysical poets and explaining what a metaphysical conceit is, and we were comparing that a little bit to some of Chesterton's paradoxes, and mentioned also the fact that someone in America, at a very primitive time in America when the country was just being settled, was in contact. Edward Taylor, a Puritan here in America in New England, was in contact evidently with some of the poetry that was going on in England and wrote metaphysical poems that were never brought to light until the 1930s, and a few of them which were very, very good. So at any rate, we'll go on. The synonymous nature of the metaphysical conceit and the Chestertonian paradox becomes immediately apparent if the former word is replaced by the latter in the above passage. And you can. You can go in and just replace the word conceit with paradox, and it makes perfect sense. So again, as I was saying, it could be that Chesterton took some of his paradoxical ideas from the metaphysical poets. At any rate, Gardner goes on and says, a metaphysical conceit is not indulged in for its own sake. It is used to persuade, and that's what Chesterton did with his paradoxes. He used them to persuade, or it is used to define or to prove a point. And again, in a metaphysical poem, the conceits are instruments of definition in an argument or instruments to persuade. The poem has something to say which the conceit explicates, or something to urge which the conceit helps to forward. I have said that the first impression a conceit makes is of ingenuity rather than that of justice. The metaphysical conceit aims at making us concede justness while admiring ingenuity. And they are ingenious. I mean, it's very difficult to compare your love, you know, to a flea or to a compass or these very, you know, metaphysical comparisons. They leave the world of the fact and material and make the comparison work because they move into the metaphysical, that is, the above the physical, the spiritual, usually. And, of course, John Donne wrote quite a bit of spiritual poetry. Having discussed the defining feature of metaphysical poetry, let us begin our brief survey of four of the metaphysical poets. The martyr Jesuit Saint Robert Southwell is one of the greatest Englishmen in the whole of England's long and checkered history. A convert to the faith who was forced into exile in order to study for the priesthood, Southwell returned to the shores of his homeland to minister in secret to England's outlawed Catholics. And we talked about that when we studied Shakespeare, when Pierce comments on Shakespeare. As with the other English Jesuit missionaries to England, Southwell knew that if caught, he faced imprisonment, torture, and an excruciatingly slow death through being hanged, drawn, and quartered. He knew also that Queen Elizabeth's extensive spy network amongst the Catholic community made it very likely that he would be caught, sooner or later. In the event, he eluded arrest for several years. During this time, he befriended Shakespeare's patron, the Earl of Southampton, becoming his confessor, and in all probability, he became a confidant of Shakespeare himself. Whereas England's anti-Catholic propagandists condemned Southwell as a traitor and a spy in the service of Rome, he was to England's beleaguered Catholics a dashing and daring hero, more akin to the Scarlet Pimpernel of later legend. The difference was that the Scarlet Pimpernel was a fictional hero during the Great Terror in France, whereas Robert Southwell was a real-life hero, one of God's spies during the earlier terror in England. Following his arrest in 1592, Southwell was tortured repeatedly and imprisoned for 3 years before facing gruesome execution. At the time of his death, his poetry was widely known and widely read, even by his enemies. He would influence many of the greatest poets in the English language, including Shakespeare, most notably, but also Michael Drayton, Edmund Spenser, John Donne, George Herbert, Richard Crashaw, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. More importantly, he was canonized in 1970 by Pope Paul VI as one of the 40 martyrs of England and Wales. Although Southwell's poetry is important in its own right, it is of added value because of its influence on Shakespeare, who alludes to Southwell's poetry in several of his plays, particularly in Romeo and Juliet, The Merchant of Venice, Hamlet, and King Lear. Nowhere in this connection more evident than in the connection between Southwell's use of God's spice in one of his poems and Shakespeare's punning reference to it as God's spies. In King Lear, Southwell's poem, Decease Release, written in the first person with Mary Stuart, Queen of Scots, as the narrator, refers to the executed queen as pounded spice. And Mary, of course, is narrating the poem. And I'll quote some of it. The pounded spice both taste and scent doth please, meaning that once the spice is crushed, that's when you can taste it and smell it. In fading smoke, the force doth incense show, meaning that when you burn incense and it's fading away in the smoke, that's when we can smell it the strongest. And, of course, that's, you know, something that the Catholic Church does and did then and still does now. The parish kernel springeth with increase. And Christ, you know, mentioned that the seed of wheat has to die before it springs to life again, and is, you know, it's sort of a reference to the resurrection. The lopped tree doth best and sooneth grow, meaning if you prune a tree, it grows better and faster. God's spice I was, Mary is saying this, God's spice I was his spice. Pounding was my due, meaning her being executed, her mistreatment at the hands of Elizabeth. Was her due. She needed, you know, that was what made her become, you know, the incense and the flavor that she would not have been without that. In fading breath, my incense savored best. Death was the mean my kernel to renew. By lopping, shot I up to heavenly rest. Meaning, because, you know, she had her head cut off, she was brought to redemption. She was brought to salvation. And so, you know, this crushed spice is what the Southwell is saying and others are saying, that it actually, to be a martyr is what our church actually says, you know, the blood of the church, you know, I mean, the faith.
The life of the church.
Yeah, the life of the church, the renewal of the church is the blood of the martyrs. And so they are the spice.
Although it's interesting to note that Pope used to wear red shoes, noting that on the blood of the martyrs stood the church.
Yeah, the foundation. The foundation of the church is on the blood of the martyrs, the bones, the crushed bones and blood of the martyrs. And that's what the poem here is, spice. And then Shakespeare puns on it. When he, in one of his plays, in Kingslayer's plays, he refers to God's spies. And it's a play on the word spice. And so he is referring to Southall's poetry, and surely he knew Southall. Although the poem is Southall's tribute to the executed Queen of Scots, its being written in the first person gave it added potency. In other words, Mary herself is saying it, following his own execution. Like the martyred queen of whom he wrote, Southall was also pounded spice, whose essence is more pleasing and valued for being crushed. God's spice I was, and pounding was my due. As a Jesuit in Elizabethan England, Southall had been one of God's spies, who being caught became God's spice, ground to death that he might receive his martyr's reward in heaven. And notice that word that he uses, ground, and ground spice. And we might get that also, I think, from, was it Ignatius, that on his way to his death at the hands of the Romans being persecuted, I'm trying to remember if it was Ignatius, or it was one of the early martyrs who was being taken, in effect, in a cage, like a caged animal, and being brought to Rome for a horrible execution, be put into the lion's den, so to speak, and be torn apart by animals. He uses that word ground. I am to be ground, like God's wheat, I think he says. I'm sure that Southall, probably picked up that particular description and phrase from the reading about, from the what Ignatius's letter, one of Ignatius's letters that survived, has this allusion, I will be ground by the teeth of animals. And so it's probably here that Southall picks up his description, ground spice, and the idea that the spice, you become the spice of the church just like the early martyrs did.
Vaguely, I remember that story, but I really can't place what saint it was that was taken and he mentioned that.
It's either Irenaeus. It might have been Irenaeus. It's either Irenaeus or Ignatius. I can't remember which. Maybe it was Irenaeus, I think, on his way. It was about 185 A.D., and he's talking about, his being ground by the wild, I'm to be ground by wild animals. In other words, he would not refute Christ.
Right.
So, at any rate, it goes on here, upon such sacrifices, Shakespeare exclaims through the lips of Lear immediately after the pruning reference, after the punning reference to God's spies, the gods themselves throw incense. So, in other words, Shakespeare is saying that when a martyr like this dies, God himself, or the gods in Lear throw incense, but God himself uses it to actually further his church. And then we'll go on to John Donne. John Donne was baptized as a Catholic and connected through his mother with St. Thomas More, but switched his allegiance to the Anglican Church when still a young man. Well, it was very difficult for John Donne to find employment, to get work, to get along. He went to university and so forth along with the Anglicans and along with Protestants, but Catholics were very, very, of course, discriminated against in Protestant England at that time, at John Donne's time. And so he was born and baptized a Catholic, but he switched his allegiance to the Anglican Church when still a young man, mainly to try to make his way. His father died when he was very young. His father left some money, but not a lot. And it was difficult for a person at that time without family and without a title or anything like that to get along and to make a living, and his Catholicism made it even harder, and so one of the reasons he probably switched was because of that. Thereafter, he commenced the writing of religious polemic against the Catholic Church, and that could be a lot of times to try to convince yourself that you did the right thing, or it simply could be you want to please those people who, you actually change your faith in order to have them help you along in life. At any rate, he seems to have paid a high psychological price for his apostasy, evident in the dark satire and disturbed skepticism of one of his works called The Progress of the Soul in 1601. a work that exhibited a mind and heart in turmoil. It was not until his ordination into the Anglican ministry in 1614 that he acquired a sense of theological settlement and stability, though not without the occasional attacks of doubt. And he had turned down, he had been asked to be ordained a number of times by rank, and he could have done it, and he didn't. He turned it down several times. So you can see he was probably wrestling with his conscience. The poems of Donne that every Catholic should read would include his Holy Sonnets and also his longer poem, Good Friday, 1613, Riding Westward. And George Herbert was the son of Lady Magdalene Herbert, to whom Donne addressed his Holy Sonnets. Like Donne, Herbert took Anglican orders. In both his life and works, he represents the early flowering of that Anglo-Catholicism which was being championed in his day by William Laud. In other words, when Protestantism in England at least first changed, you know, from, you know, Catholicism to Protestantism, it was actually, you know, Anglican. Everything about Catholicism was pretty well kept, and so it was very close to Catholicism at that time. But at any rate,
don't many of the high church, they call them high church Anglicans to this day, consider themselves Catholic?
Yeah, a lot of them still do. They consider themselves Catholic. I think maybe that is more, I'm not sure, but more dying out than it ever did earlier. But yes, some of them do. In fact, actually, some of their liturgy and their Book of Songs and so forth are actually more beautiful than what we have in some of the changes that we made in Catholicism. But nevertheless, it's still a movement away from Catholicism. He died in the same year that Laud, later to be beheaded for endeavoring to overthrow the Protestant religion, became Archbishop of Canterbury. Poems by George Herbert that should be on the reading list of every Catholic include Easter, The Agony, Vanity, Virtue, The Pulley, and Love. So again, you can see some of these have those metaphysical conceits. Comparing unlike things to each other. And you can see also that Protestantism could be very dangerous in that day. I mean, you could tip over the wrong way or be accused of something very easily, and you could be in some serious, serious trouble and suffer a very horrible death. But at any rate, we're going
to
go ahead and take a break here. Stay
with
us. We'll be right back.
On Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.
This weekend, we have a text fundraiser where your donations will be tripled thanks to the support of three matching donors. So for every dollar received, Catholic Spirit Radio will receive $4 thanks to our matching donors. Thank you in advance to Dave Stokes of Edward Jones, Dr. Sarah Round of Pediatric Smiles in Bloomington, and an anonymous donor. Simply text GIVE to 309-233-0086 anytime between now and Sunday night. That's GIVE to 309-233-0086.
Hi, this is Bob Johnston. You're listening to Being Catholic right here on Catholic Spirit Radio. We're back from our break. We're talking about literature, what every Catholic should know. And we're talking about the metaphysical poets. We're going to finish up here with metaphysical and then talk a little bit about the Romantic poets. And when we talk about the Romantic poets, we'll see why it's necessary to preserve the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church and be there. Because we're living in a world in which we have strayed very, very far from the traditions of Catholicism and, I think, sanity. And people will be coming back to it, and there has to be a place for them to return. Just like we've gone through these periods that we're talking about, and there was a huge falling away and some very, very large turmoil, and people came back, we'll see the movement of coming back to the Catholic Church by some of the Romantic poets. And
it may give us hope for the future because we're going through a falling away now.
What happens when there's a falling away and the fact that it's necessary not so much to be successful as to be faithful. But at any rate, Richard Crashaw, the son of a Puritan clergyman, converted to Catholicism during the English Civil War, and was forced into exile. Living in abject poverty in Paris and then in Rome, he was eventually appointed in April 1649 to the post of subcanon of the Cathedral of Loreto, Italy, dying only 4 months later. A devotee of St. Teresa of Avila, he is a poet of the stature of the great St. John of the Cross, that other great poet and follower of St. Teresa, who also suffered greatly for the faith. So we need to remember, I want to get that in because as I got in with Shakespeare, we need to remember that the persecution of Catholics didn't occur only back in Roman times. There was a huge persecution of Catholics, especially in England and, of course, in Calvin's Geneva and in other places in Europe as well during the Protestant Reformation. So, at any rate, I want to get into a little bit of Milton. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Romantic poets, and then we'll come back and pick up Milton and Dryden. And we'll do it a little bit, instead of going into Milton and Dryden first, we'll come back and pick them up
a little
later. They're
going to take quite a bit more time.
Yeah, right. William Blake, William Wordsworth, and Samuel Taylor Coleridge are sometimes called the early Romantic poets in recognition of their pioneering role in English Romanticism and as a means of distinguishing them from the second generation of Romantic poets, of which the most prominent were Lord Byron, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and John Keats. So you have the first generation and then the second generation, Blake, Wordsworth, and Taylor, and then Byron, Shelley, and Keats. But in the afterword to the third edition of the Pilgrim's Regress, C.S. Lewis complained that Romanticism had acquired so many different meanings that, as a word, it had become meaningless. And Pierce here begs to differ with Lewis, and he says, if we banished words because they have multifarious meanings or because their meaning is abused or debased by maladroit and malapropism, that is by, you know, misusing the meaning and of the word and misusing the word, we should soon find it impossible to say anything at all. Take, for example, the word love. Few words are more abused, yet few words are more necessary to an understanding of ourselves. And so he goes on, he says, if we are to advance in understanding, we must abandon the notion of abolishing the word and commence instead with a definition of our terms. And that is something the modern world so much needs. There are so many arguments today, in my opinion, at any rate, where people are at odds with each other over two different things because they don't bother to define what they're talking about anymore. But Lewis, in spite of his protestations, also understood this truth and proceeded from his plaintive call for the abolition of the word to the enumeration of various definitions of it, claiming that we can distinguish at least in seven kinds of things which are called romantic. And so at any rate, he goes on to define romanticism in a number of ways. But Pierce says, what makes romanticism distinct, or to return to our initial question, what is it? According to the Collins Dictionary of Philosophy, romanticism is a style of thinking and looking at the world that dominated 19th century Europe. Arising in early medieval culture, it referred originally to tales in the Romance language about courtly love and other sentimental topics as distinct from works in classical Latin. From the beginning, therefore, Romanticism stood in contradistinction to Classicism. The former referred to an outlook marked by refined and responsive feeling, and thus could be said to be inward-looking, subjective, sensitive, and given to noble dreams. The latter, that is, classicism, is marked by empiricism, governed by science and precise measures, and could be said to be outward-looking or objective. In other words, in medieval times, the two were connected together as faith and reason. And they were never separated. They were connected, thinking that, you know, the idea that they were two parts of a human being, two parts of good thought, and two parts of actually living in the world, faith and reason. You needed both. And, of course, the church still teaches that today. It was with, in my opinion, at any rate, the Enlightenment and the Reformation that faith and reason were separated from each other. Having defined our terms, albeit in the broadest and most sweeping sense, we can proceed to a discussion of the ways in which human society has oscillated between the two alternative visions. First, however, we must insist that the oscillation in itself is an aberration. It's a product of modern times. And as I was saying, back in medieval times, the two were considered both wings, you know, of proper thinking, proper reasoning, and proper living. At any rate, the nexus of philosophy and theology in the Platonic, Augustinian, and Aristotelian Thomistic view of man represented the fusion of faith and reason, the uniting of it. Take, for example, the use of the figurative or the allegorical in medieval literature, or the use of symbolism in medieval art. The function of the figurative in medieval art and literature was not intended primarily to arouse spontaneous feelings in the observer or reader, but to encourage the observer or reader to see the philosophical or theological significance beneath the symbolic configuration. In this sense, medieval art, informed by medieval philosophy and theology, is much more objective and outward-looking than the most realistic examples of modern art. The former points to abstract ideas which are the fruits of a philosophical tradition existing independently of either the artist or the observer. In other words, in the medieval philosophy, representations come from a tradition that is outside of the observer and the times themselves. And didn't we get that in Shakespeare? We got that because critics came to understand that when William Shakespeare was expressing his religion, it was clear that it was not his religion in the sense of Protestant religion being taken subjectively by the person and being made into what the person wants it to be. William Shakespeare's religion came to him from the outside. And that's how Catholic religion comes to us. It's transcendental, just like God in Catholicism is transcendental. He stands outside of the universe, and we look to God outside of the universe and world we're living in as a governing factor of that world. And there is a rationalism, a sensible way of looking at the world that comes into it when we think of God in that manner. But when we become subjective, which some of the Romantic poets did, and cut themselves loose from the other side, that is, from the objective, reason part of it, then we get a pure subjectivism in which everything comes from our own inside, and our religion then is made into what we want it to be, mostly through our subjective feelings, disattached from looking at the world from a sensible point of view as God would have us look at it from the outside. So, and we are getting more and more of that. In other words, materialism always degenerates into subjectivism. When we start with this world, instead of starting with God outside of this world, we subjectivize it into what we want it to be, and we get to the point where we're having people who are absolutely narcissistic. Everything is them. Religion and everything else is simply what they want it to be. And we reach a point when we lose touch with reality and we have people insisting that they can become something other than what they are.
Ah, bingo. It sounds like today.
Right. That's what I'm pointing out. And you have a difference. And you can see that in literature. You can read Shakespeare and you can read Milton, for example, when we get into Milton. And Shakespeare's religion and his look at the world and understanding of it comes from outside of himself, and Milton's comes from inside of himself. And there are huge differences there. And that is a product, actually, of the Reformation separating faith and reason, really, separating the two and making them and separating the material world from the spiritual world, separating man's body from man's soul. We get into Locke, and he expressed this in his philosophy. The founders picked it up and expressed it into their foundation of our country. and foundation of the modern world through the French Revolution and all throughout the rest of the modern world. And we see this dichotomy at work, this dichotomy at work in our society today, splitting it, and we are having huge troubles because of it. So we don't have the foundation for Western civilization that we had when we had the Catholic Church and the state distinct from each other, but not supposedly separate from each other. And that's what we have to, in my opinion, reunite if we're going to have a sensible world to live in again.
Now, so, go back to the beginning of the program. Right. You know, you're confusing a she for a he. It kind of points to what's going on today. The confusion.
And this is what we get when I'm talking about the Romantics. We have Wordsworth and Coleridge, and if you read their poetry, they start out with this rejection of the Enlightenment, rejection of the French Revolution, a wanting a greater emphasis on the natural and the feeling and so forth. But as they age, they begin to realize that has to be attached to something, and they gravitate, both of them, strongly toward the Catholic Church. And this is what I'm saying by we need to be there. We need to have that orthodoxy still there, practiced as it was handed on down to us. Even when it seems like everyone is leaving it or things are flying apart, we need to remain faithful because that base has to be there. When people start moving away, the people are starting to become confused, and even younger people are starting to get tired of the kind of world we're living in. They're looking for something better than that, that can somehow unite body and soul, and that is the Catholic Church. And Wordsworth and Coleridge gravitated toward it. William Blake also sort of gravitated toward it, even though he had a very dark side. But we had Byron and Shelley, which we'll get into more. And
next time,
They began to deviate, and they began to gravitate toward a dark romanticism that began to reject reason, began to reject rules and regulations, and we sort of have gravitated toward that today again. And we need that strong base to be there when people reject that and return, which they will. So that's one of the things the Catholic Church has to do, and what we have to do as Catholics. We don't need to be successful. We need to be faithful.
That's kind of what Mother Teresa said to do small things with love. St. Teresa of also said that with the child Jesus.
And
it isn't success that is our crowning glory.
If Wordsworth and Coleridge, in their reaction against the Enlightenment, had rediscovered the purity and passion of Christianity, the other great Romantic poet, William Blake, in his own chaotically eccentric way, was also reacting against the Enlightenment.
He was.
Lamenting the dark satanic mills of industrialism, although he shared the desire of Wordsworth and Coleridge for a purer vision untainted by Enlightenment rationalism, his dabbling in theology was singularly peculiar and ultimately heterodox, which is not to say that his wonderful poetry is not worth reading. Blake is one that sort of like is in the middle. He sort of straddles both sides of the fence. He sees the order and beauty in Christianity, and then he moves over to the purely secular materialism that was beginning to operate in the day, almost the Darwinism. You know, the red tooth and claw of the natural world, and he oscillates.
Yeah.
He oscillates from one to the other. You know, he goes back and forth. One minute he's talking about the lamb, and the next minute he's talking about the tiger. And you see that in Blake. So
getting close to
right. Okay, the pattern of reaction initiated by the first wave of Romantic poets would be repeated in the various manifestations of neo-medievalism that would follow. And so you had a separation of the mystical in Protestantism from the practical, you know, from the secular, from the material and a reason, which you had a unity of that in Catholicism. And there is a need in man for that. And we begin to see this in the rise of the Gothic. There were various renewals and revivals. The Gothic revival was one. You had the revival, you know, you had the invention of and the rise of the Gothic novel. Bram Stoker's Dracula is a good example of that. You started getting these horror books, but the reason for a lot of that is because they bring man into this mysterious world of the occult and so forth. And why do people start to dabble with that so much? It's because there is a hunger for the mystical that has gone out of a lot of the Protestant thinking, especially the Puritan Protestant thinking of that time. We'll get into that with Milton as we begin to see that Milton's God becomes sort of sanitized and becomes materialistic and far distant and not approachable. And Milton's Satan becomes, in effect, heroic-like, and you're attracted to Satan instead of to God. And so people begin to be attracted to the Gothic and to the dark side of things because they're missing the mystical. That happens when there's a separation of the body and soul, and when there's a separation of the mystical from the reasonable. You need both faith and reason. The Catholic Church understands that. And we have to remain in our tradition to be faithful and be there when there's this huge need to return to that sane and resolving base. So we're going to have to stop here, and we'll come back next week. We're going to say our closing prayer. Please pray for us. We'll pray for you. St. Michael the Archangel,
defend us in battle.
Be our protection against the wickedness and snares of the devil. May God rebuke him, we humbly pray. And do thou, O Prince of the heavenly hosts, by the power of God, thrust into hell Satan and all evil spirits who wander through the world for the ruin of souls. Amen.
You've been listening to Being Catholic with Bob Johnston on Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5. If you'd like to contact Bob, email bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Again, that's bob@catholicspiritradio.com. Catholic Spirit Radio relies on your support to bring programming like this and EWTN to Central Illinois 24 hours a day. Please help keep Catholic Spirit Radio on the air with your generous support. Donate online at catholicspiritradio.com. Or send a donation to Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. That's Catholic Spirit Radio, 108 Boykins Place, Normal, Illinois, 61761. Catholic Spirit Radio is a 501c3, and all donations are tax deductible. Thank you for your support of Catholic Spirit Radio 89.5.